Do you remember the very first time you went home, kind of like cold sweat because it had lost a decent amount of money?
Oh, I mean, to be honest, I don't remember very many specific versions of that because that happened all the time. I would have nightmares.
The Business of Betting podcast is presented by Optimove, the number one CRM marketing solution for the iGaming industry. 4 out of the top 5 U.S. operators personalize player experiences with Optimove, the number one CRM marketing solution for the iGaming industry. If you are attending SBC Summit North America, make sure to visit the Optimove stand at the event in New Jersey from May 7th to 9th, and we'll look forward to seeing you there.
What is up, everybody? I am Jason Trost, the host of the Business of Betting podcast. Today, we have repeat guests, I believe, from episode 56. Today is episode 210. We are re-welcoming Matthew Trinnell to the podcast. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me on, Jason.
Great. So we decided that Matthew would kick off by asking me a few questions, and then we'll get into it. Matt, for those of you that aren't familiar with Matthew, he's been around the industry forever, market maker, syndicate, used to do FX, worked at Spread Betting. He's been in the industry, I think you're about the same age as I am, and he's been in the industry 20 years, something like that.
Yeah, I'm 42. So
I'm 43. So if you want to know how the future will look like, give me a call and we can talk about... What's in store for you the next 6 months?
Well, I can say that if I look even slightly you with your BMI, then this next year is going to be amazing. So I don't think that comes naturally with 43, that's for sure.
I don't know what happened, but about a year ago, I kind of got on a huge health kick. And so I've been, if you've heard of him, I'm really into Peter Attia with his Outlive book, and I've been working out. And so I've kind of like, once I hit 40, I was like, oh shit, I can't eat pizza and drink Bud Light my whole life and live healthily for the rest of my life. So I've kind of kicked my kicked myself into gear.
Right. Let's talk exchanges, and let's talk about you. I was just saying before we started this that I don't think I've ever heard of anyone with, I suppose, explicit domain knowledge actually grill you. You're very good at detailing some of the journey that you've been on and the complexities of it. But there are things that I want to go way back. Right to the beginning. Like, so I remember Flutter when it was a product, not the name of a listed company. And I remember, you know, Andrew Black's vision and Betfair's arrival. I remember BetDAX's emergence. I remember the first and only spread betting exchange, Cantor Spreadfair, WBX, may it rest in peace. Of course, Matchbook, Smarkets. So, I know why you found the concept and the idea of exchanges appealing. What made you say, I see what's already here in the exchange landscape? It's not enough for me just to play and have fun on the exchanges. I mean, you're a smart guy. You could have just been a market maker, maybe. You could have just played around on Betfair. You could have continued your financial career. But you not only wanted to be involved with exchanges, you wanted to actually set up your own exchange. So what was it that made you feel that, like, what's already there is just not satisfying, not delivering, you know, what can I bring to the table?
Yeah, so I'll give a quick version of the founding story. So studied computer science, was a stock trader when I graduated, was and still am a huge, huge political junkie. I follow politics way more than I should and spend a lot of my free time reading about what's going on in that world. And I came across a website called InTrade, which was a U.S.-facing betting exchange back in the day, now defunct. I forget what year they went out, maybe 2012 or something like that. But in 2004 is when I first came across it. It's the Bush-Kerry election. And I thought, holy shit, here's something that, you know, you can take the principles of financial trading, apply to the outcome of an election. And I thought, this is amazing stuff. The sort of the light bulb moment for me was that even as a professional trader and somebody that had a software background, I thought the interface was horrible. So, you know, I was like, on one hand, seeing InTrade on one side of my screen, on the other, I had these sort of, it was quite advanced for back in 2003 or 2004, but like real-time charts, level two, the depth of book, you know, sort of movement of money, all these kinds of things that are, they're kind of second nature now. But back then they were quite, you know, forward thinking in the stock trading world. And I thought, this is such a cool concept that you can trade not some stock that you could give two shits about, but you're trading something that everybody cares about. You know, is Bush going to win or Kerry going to win? But, you know, I was like, there's got to be a better way to do it. The technology is obviously there, but nobody's using it. So that was kind of the first hook. The second hook was one of my mates from undergrad was living in London, working at an options market making firm called Wolverine. And two of the guys he traded with were big Betfair horse guys. They're Irish guys. They were really into the horses and used Betfair all the time. And they were just complaining about the transaction fees. So we were talking over beers one day and I had a look at it. And, you know, not only could you trade politics, I saw you could trade sports, which wasn't obvious at the time. And I thought, this is super cool. And from my stock trading point of view, my first boss beat into my head that everything is about price. You know, whether you make a lot of money or lose money, it's like, are you paying the spread, not paying the spread? Don't pay the spread. And I was like, well, what are people paying to trade sports? And it turns out it's like 5, 10%. You know, when in stock trading, you would like a penny is the difference between making money and losing money. And I thought, holy shit, who pays 5, 10% to trade sports or politics or anything? And it turns out a lot of people do. And that was kind of those two ideas were the key reason I got into it. So basically this idea of taking betting markets and applying it to real world events, I don't think anybody's really done that very well. I mean, you sort of have the Kalshis and the poly markets and stuff like that, but it's still not in sort of the mainstream zeitgeist. It's still kind of a niche thing for internet nerds to kind of play with. I think it should be in sort of the daily news. I think it's, you know, it's up there with like BBC or New York Times, like a betting, when run properly, a betting market could really help the world prognosticate the future. And the second thing, which is probably my emotive reason for really banging on markets for so long, is it really, really, really pisses me off how much people are getting ripped off every time they place a bet. And, you know, there's no low cost alternative. I mean, maybe Pinnacle sort of, maybe some of the exchanges sort of, but generally speaking, people are getting ripped off every time they place a bet. So that was maybe too long of an answer, but
I'm interested that, so, I mean, looking back at Betfair back then, you know, undoubtedly, if you'd said to me, I felt the UI could be improved upon, or if you had said to me that I feel they're just not marketing this correctly, or they're not getting the messaging correct, but you've honed in specifically on price and the commercial structures of how they've been doing it. And for me, I'm now thinking, if I'm the VC taking the pitch back then, I suppose my next question is, okay, so you have a really good run. People are attracted to this market's, you know, new fee structure. You know, you're taking away market share from Betfair. I'm thinking to myself, what's the next step if Betfair decides to try and build their moat back up? What if they slash the costs? Like, what was the next area of competition beyond? Like, if we have this, I worked in the CFD or Contracts for Difference FX sort of retail sector. And we had what we called this race to the bottom, where people were giving fewer and fewer pips to retail traders, you know, spread widths, you know, and like were 10 pips wide, then someone was eighth and someone was sixth and et cetera, et cetera. So if I was to deny you, or rather let's say that we have got to the commission rate or commission function that is bearable for people to still make money, what's the next I can beat out the competition doing this better. What was the next thing?
The next thing, I mean, going back in the time capsule, this is sort of when Facebook started taking off and sort of the social media was still quite nascent, but I could kind of see that there was a lot of trends to it. If you go back and look at old Smarkets business plans, a lot of it was around social betting. So the social betting was kind of an outcropping of a few things. One, I was an early adopter on Facebook. You know, I think I signed up to Facebook in 2008 or 9 and maybe even... No, I signed it to Facebook. Anyway, I was a very early Facebook user. And I thought, holy shit, this is really cool for the obvious reasons that made Facebook really special. I also did some project in university, which we called 6 Degrees, which was basically Facebook before Facebook. And unfortunately, we didn't end up spending that out into a startup. But the idea was that you could get to know people on campus by using this sort of this website that we kind of built a prototype for. So I was into the technology of social networks before Facebook. And the third thing was, from my experience trading, I noticed that traders never want to shut the fuck up about what they're trading about. They want to talk about it. They want to talk all day long about what's on their mind, like what's looking good, what's looking bad, what's working, what's not working. And then, I kind of realized if you look at CNBC, CNBC was basically a social network before there were social networks. The old school CNBC was traders going on CNBC talking about the same thing. So it was kind of this idea of like, what's the vibe in the marketplace? So if you combine all these things, people who are trading generally anything want to talk about what they're trading. And there wasn't a place to do that in sports. And so I thought, you know, the convergence of all this technology, if you took all this sort of social networking stuff, had a better trading platform, lower cost fees, and then you layer on social networking, that was the pitch.
I would say that at this point, you still either haven't been able to really fulfill that ambition with the social networking aspect, or did you get to the point where you realized that wasn't going to work? Because right now I like talking to other people about trading, but I don't see currently how SmartMarkets facilitates my ability to talk about my trading so much. Or have I missed
something? We don't at all. I mean, well, that's not, I mean, in the SBK, there's some very small social features that you can sort of comment and do tips and things like that. But in SmartMarkets, we don't at all. We experimented with group chats and that just kind of became noise and not that interesting. The pragmatic truth was it just always fell to the bottom of the roadmap because there's so many things to do for sort of the vanilla betting, if you like, either vanilla pricing or vanilla markets or vanilla features, that this sort of experimental social anger never really bubbled to the top. I always kind of thought that it would need a lot of, I always thought about it like a fast food recipe. Like you want to launch a new chicken and you got to spend a lot of time making, you know, thousands of different types of chicken to see what, you know, what people really want to eat. And we just never had the resources or the time, or at least made the resources of the time to experiment with the social model that would layer on top of SmartMarkets. Combine that with the fact that as Betfair, for such a dominant position that they were in like 2010 and before, they have invested very little in their interface. They've invested very little in their market making technology or their API, and they have made their transaction fees, you know, or at least have kept them relatively expensive. So all those things that could have put competitive pressure on us, they never ended up doing it. So that also didn't put pressure on us to try to come up with something new that we could help respond to the sort of that potential race to the bottom. But lastly, I'll say as an insider, the other thing I thought was interesting about the race to the bottom, at this time in 2012, we were 12 people, 15 people. So you can imagine our fixed costs were very low. And Betfair at the time, I'm making something up, but they might've been 1,000 people. So I was like, they can't do a race to the bottom. Like to keep the lights on costs, you know, $100 million a year or something like that. So if there's a race to the bottom, we win that race. It wasn't like we were both 1,000-person companies, and kind of thought that I was always kind of interested in a race to the bottom because I think that I thought that would play to our strengths.
I'm going to push back slightly on you. One thing that was interesting was that, and I feel like this is something that the way I think of you and possibly your, I suppose, I consider you someone who probably appreciates the concept of open source. I think that Betfair potentially sidestepped some of the UI aspect and they opened up, they called it an app store, but essentially they allowed people to create these third-party trading platforms. And I don't know about you, I mean, I worked in finance. I find ladders the most brutally fucking confusing thing in the world. But it seemed that people got, there was this period, definitely that mid-noughties period, where people were shilling the hell out the dream that you could basically sit in your bedroom trading ladders on pre-racing, you know, pre-race horse racing markets, etc. And so there were a lot of people I knew who were trading actively, and they were using a Bet Angel or a Geek's Toy or one of these other sort of third-party softwares. So maybe if I see that gain good traction, and some of those early people who made the software also became, I suppose, dare I call it even an influencer, like they were making YouTube content, this kind of stuff. Maybe they felt that, well, actually, we don't want to invest effort into creating that kind of trading platform software. So my question to you is, you will have seen that phenomenon. What did you make of it? Did you think that's going to die a death? Or maybe if we had time, we had more staff, we should consider building our own kind of financial, you know, financialified trading platform? Where was that in your mindset, I suppose, in those days?
Yeah, I think it was more like we probably should build it ourselves. I kind of, you know, in the open source tech geek side of me, I have a natural inclination to want to do everything ourselves, which is both good and bad. I think it's, for most of SmartMarkets, it's been mostly good, but When I see a lot of those things, I think let's just build a better version of that, which we obviously never ended up building a sort of a desktop ladder view trading interface. That was part of it. Part of it was my co-founder and I had the idea that there's a financial protocol called FIX. I don't know if you've come across that.
Yeah.
But it's sort of it's kind of the bog standard protocol that all trading systems are built on top of. And our holy grail, which we never ended up, we put some prototypes together, but we never finished it, was basically to build the exchange using the FIX protocol. So all the third-party tools, you know, leaving aside, like, you don't even need BetAngel if you build on FIX. So the idea would be you could take any one of number of front ends that are FIX, are able to use a FIX protocol, and that would work even better than sort of the BetAngels of the world. So that was partially our hypothesis, and we just never ended up getting there.
Because you also mentioned actually sort of Betfair's API. And what's interesting is this sort of has actually crept into my mind, because recently I observed an interaction on X whereby there's a new man sort of promoting within BetDAC and trying to gauge feedback via X from people, users of BetDAC. And one of the questions from one of the people there was, is there any plan for BetDAC to upgrade their API from, I call it SOAP, I don't know if you're supposed to say SOAP or SOAP API. And I remember the moment, everyone bitched and moaned about the new Betfair API, the new push API that they rolled out, because obviously everything they'd built broke overnight kind of thing. But the general consensus posthumously was, how great is this compared to what we had? You know, we're not making calls anymore. You know, it was definitely an upgrade. And there were a lot of people consuming that API. Now, you have limited access to the API. You know, you want to make sure that the people who use your API are vetted appropriately and presumably are adding to your ecosystem. You know, you want people only to use it who you think will benefit the ecosystem. Why did you sort of be so much more restrictive compared to Betfair and who had access to it? Why don't you just let people run wild, build stuff on top of this? Do, you know, get in there, you know, try and break us. Let's see how many orders we can process. What sort of, why didn't you go down that route?
Well, Occam's razor, because it would break us.
Right.
Hopefully. It depends what era are we talking about here.
When you very
the historical
first...
era or the modern era?
Yeah, historical era, I guess you would have observed, obviously, the getting access to the Betfair API. I mean, back then, it was trivially easy to get access to Betfair API. They very much allowed it opening. So when you first built Smarkets, were those early roadmaps like, yes, we're definitely going to allow everyone the same level of access that they have at Betfair? Or was there a conscious decision even then, right at the initial stages? See the Betfair do that. Don't think that's going to work for the way I think this works out. What was their initial decision back then?
Well, basically, we wanted to have an open API. The issue, pragmatically speaking, was that we sort of had a single point of failure backend that everything flowed through, and we had written our own market maker out of pragmatism. Like when I founded Smarkets, I had no intention of being in the risk business, but because I know you used to work at Mustard, but of the Gambits of the world and the betting promotions of the world, we were too small for them to sort of add to us to the roadmap to market make on our platform. And so out of necessity, we'll build our own market maker. So once we started to build our own market maker, we built our own exchange, then we built our own market maker. There's a funny story, which I don't think I've ever told this in public, but basically I remember the early pitches. My co-founder is one of the smartest engineers I've ever worked with. He's an incredibly brilliant engineer. And we built the exchange to be very, very, very scalable, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of trades per second. And so we kind of like, he's building this, he's prototyping everything. And I'm thinking like, this is great. You know, I'm telling investors we can handle hundreds, if not thousands of orders per second. And I think at some point we were live, and then we actually needed to test the system. And the way it was set up, it could do 5 orders per second, which if you're not from the exchange space is not very much to run an exchange off of. So long story short, we didn't have the bandwidth, the early Smarket days, to basically go open garden on our API.
Right.
At some point we did have the bandwidth and we did go open garden, and I'm blanking on the exact date. I want to say like 15, 16, 17, we kind of had a more open garden approach. I think at some point we got up to 200 clients. The big issue with the API is that we're a market maker on our platform, and you're very aware of adverse selection and information asymmetry and all those kinds of wonderful things. And being a company that hasn't raised that much money, you know, up until 2021, we had raised $5 million over 12 years. And so we had to be profitable. We had to, you know, cover our costs and all those kinds of things. We were very sensitive to this adverse selection cost. And if you open up the API, most API, or at least real API users, are positive EV bettors. And we knew that our own market making algorithm had tons and tons of bugs in it. We knew we'd just get eaten alive because we can see the bugs, but we just don't have enough engineers to kind of fix things fast enough. So that's kind of where we're at right now. We kind of have a closed garden approach right now because we wanted to give the market maker space and time to be able to, you know, if you're on the website, you can pick it off to your heart's content. But if you are on the API, it's way too easy to kind of pick it off. So we've really limited API users right now to market makers. And we do have ambitions to go open garden again in the future.
That feels like a real torture chamber point of anguish for me, is that I need to do my market making to provide liquidity. And yet a potential avenue to get more liquidity is denied me because I'm the one providing, like it feels kind of like a circular pain. One thing I think the geeks will definitely want to know, that moment when you realized we're going to have to provide the liquidity ourselves. I didn't want to do this. I have to do this. Day one, JSTOR, Google, exited El Trader reveals how to do market making. Like, how did you even come up with, obviously you have that options background. So you understand a probability distribution function. You understand so much. It's kind of taking that knowledge and then applying it into something that you're building and releasing into your own product. Like, what was the very first like conversation as to how that should work?
I have a stock background. My co-founder has options background. So when we first started, so even though I have a technical background, he was the CTO and he was doing the lion's share of the code. I did a little bit of coding, but I was more sort of the quote unquote business guy when we were starting. And he was writing all this complicated code. It takes a while to build. And while he was doing that, I was kind of going to conferences, trying to meet as many bettors as I could. I was new to the UK, so I spent a ton of time networking. And I actually met a lot of, I think I met your old boss, Jasper, pretty early doors, and a few other insiders in the industry. And I just got a sense very early on that this was going to be an uphill climb, that people aren't going to come. You know, I kind of thought from finance, like market making, there's a market here, like they're going to come running with open arms. But I just got very, across the industry, got cold receptions. I want to say I talked to like 10, 20 professional bettors, and they were all, maybe not that, I don't know, something of that order of magnitude. And they were kind of like, yeah, maybe, you know, call us when you get bigger. So while my co-founder was hacking away on the exchange and the interface and the trading interface, I actually wrote the first version of the market maker. I don't want to kind of go too much into the algorithm because it's a little bit of our secret sauce, but basically I did the first version. It was literally putting pennies up on the screen. It was just designed to like have a price with almost no liquidity. And I did it almost on a lark, you know, just to kind of like, while we're building the demo so that we can see something to trade on. And when we ended up going live, you know, none of these syndicates had to change their mind to start trading on our platform. So, you know, I changed the pennies to a dollar, and I changed the dollar to 10 or 10 pounds or whatever. And so gradually I made it a little bit more liquid and a little bit more. And then at a necessity, it would lose money. So we have to fix this bug. And I would say for the first 4 or 5 years, we literally just ran it to break even just to like facilitate liquidity. We had zero intentions of being in that business. And the Gambits of the world never changed their mind in terms of market making. And we just had to make our market maker better and better. Then around 2014 is when things changed. It went from sort of like break even struggling to consistently making money in 2014. And that's when we went from sort of the 10 guys around a table with a dream to we started having a real business around 2014.
Do you remember the very first time you went home kind of like cold sweat because it had lost a decent amount of money?
Oh, I mean, to be honest, I don't remember very many specific versions of that because that happened all the time. I would have nightmares. I like to tell a story like the early version of this, we call it Hansen. That's our code name for it. The early version of it had no notion of managed markets because we couldn't pay for the data to, you know, for running ball to know when to think. So I remember, I think I found some old Sport Radar page that would have a list of the Premier League matches, and it would ding a bell every time there was a goal scored. And I ran I ran this version of Hansen in the command line. So like all weekend long, I would leave this page open and every time I'd hear a bell, I'd run in, hit Control C to cancel the market maker, wait a few seconds for like, you know, the market prices to update and everything and relaunch the program. So funny that like for now, as sophisticated as it is now, like back in the day, it was just, you know, a 27-year-old just trying to like not make the thing crash.
So what's interesting is obviously, so you had that prolonged period of essentially lubricating the exchange, being that sort of trying to, you know, remove the friction for the players to play, breaking even. Now, when it became apparent that it can be more than this, if we want it to be, was there any discussions amongst you and your team? Is it right that we become adversarial with our customer base? Is it right that we as the liquidity provider is extracting alpha here? Or were there other people who were potentially going, I think, you know, obviously by providing liquidity, we generate commission. That should be our piece and no more. Was there any debate like that? Or
Of course. And I would say we had debates on that probably for 6, 7, 8 years, something like that. So it was kind of a long running conversation of like, how do we be good stewards of running an exchange, but also having, to your language, having an adversarial relationship with our customers. It's something that we've thought lots about. So we have certain guardrails about what is not possible with the market maker, things like that. And it's not easy. It's not easy.
So there will be people who probably listen to this, because I think we've got quite an international audience at this point for those listening. So the match betting phenomenon, whereby it is arbitrage, it's the gap between two prices, but exchange make it easier for novice people who want to sort of create this side income via internet opportunities, because it means to place your bet with a bookmaker and the exchange provides you the this will not happen other side of it. Visually, it's very easy to see number A bigger than number B. So there are platforms within the UK particularly that really focus on providing this. And one of the ones that SmartKits, get this out there for you, Jez, but you know, was OddsMonkey was an example of a platform that you work closely with. Now, if you wanted to, how transformational, and I want to stress that for other people, like from my perspective as a trader, I'll explain my view is that essentially all exchanges to thrive, and I mean this, all exchanges need to have people, everyone can have a directional opinion, but it's really vital to have some price unsensitive money. So if you're in the financial markets, whether it's ETF that's rebalancing, a pension fund that needs to buy a billion of Apple or whatever, like these people who just need to get money done is sort of always valuable. And the match better potentially represents in the betting ecosystem someone who is price sensitive, but not too price sensitive, because potentially they want to make money and they want to close out the trade quickly. So when you would onboard these kind of customers by working with one of these software providers, am I over egging it that was a really transformational point, you know, moment for Hansen? Was that really vital, or was that just a nice extra benefit when it came along?
No, you're nailing it. I mean, it was kind of our, it was the engine that powered SmartKits was the match betting community. It was such a boon to us to, you know, when I first founded SmartKits, you know, I kind of had those two hypotheses about price and betting markets. I didn't know anything about the microstructure of customers or arbitrage or anything like that. So when we found that match betting community by accident, almost, that was a real game changer for us. Because ultimately, betting is a zero-sum game. And I would be even a little bit more precise and say you need losing punters for any betting, any betting mechanism to work, because otherwise there's no betting, because, you know, for every dollar that's won, a dollar has to be lost. And so I think the reason why the exchange, I don't know what you think about exchanges now, but, you know, a lot of the liquidity is starting to dry up in these exchanges and our liquidity is going down year and our volume is going down year and year, just like it is on Betfair. I think it's because the lack of retail flow is getting into these exchanges for various reasons that we can get into, but you have to have the losing money in the system in any case, in any zero-sum game. So,
well, I mean, we can jump actually just straight to that, because it's a subject that I particularly wanted to talk to you about is recreational. So for me, the people that I all spoke to who are early Betfair adopters were universally professionals in finance or people who worked in betting, other traders that I knew. That was the initial cohort. of, you know, the first 30 people I knew who had Betfair accounts would all fall into that category. And they all fell into the category of, I enjoy my betting in terms of an intellectual challenge. So, you know, I think like, so my father used to commute to London from like the middle of nowhere where we lived. And he basically did the Times newspaper here, you know, cryptic crossword. And it was like, there was a team of them on the train. You know, it was a race to who would finish it first. Could you finish it before you got into Victoria in London? You know, and for these people, like it was their time, it was their cryptic crossword. It was their, like, they would do this when they got, you know, they were looking at markets all day as well, whether they were, you know, bookmakers or whether they were financial traders. And yet, you know, some might argue they were the sickos, you know, they were the ones who wanted to then look at more markets recreationally for their, but, you know, they wanted to win because they saw that as validation of skill. It's like, I don't play chess, but I'm happy to grind away the 3:15 at Wolverhampton pre-match mark, pre-race market or whatever. And I always think to myself, that is the limit of the exchange's appeal, the people who want to play an intellectual game as opposed to people who want to bet. Like for me, the fundamental core of betting as entertainment is that you get the dopamine hit the moment you place the bet. Taking risk, speculating as human, as animals, speculation is the thrill. People always talk about, like, no one bets because they want to lose. You know, everyone bets because they want to win. It's like, my argument is always, people hope they win. Hardly any people actually expect to win. People, like, if you get caught in this kind of horrible professional better circle jerk online or whatever, it's like people say, obviously people, you know, think they'll win or whatever like that. It's like, no, no, no. I speak to lots of people who literally bet full well knowing, like, well, you've never seen a poor bookmaker. Like, it's, I don't expect to win, but, you know, it'd be great if I could hit this. But the exchange power user, if we should say, they knew that it was difficult, but they were there to play it, like, intellectually. And this is sort of the, you know, if that is where the losers are coming from, these are the people who are going to sustain. Because, like, so many people would try Betfair because it just was a big noise. It was advertised in our racing press. It was advertised everywhere for a while. And the interface drove them away. They couldn't understand what the hell was going on. You put your lay bot, you know, you do a lay instead of a back, accidentally one click, never doing it again. Like, it was insanely powerful at driving away people from their first experience. And so you got these core people who were sort of like, would use heavy exchange users. And for me, they're like intellectual, like when I say, what's the exchange competing against? It's just not competing against 365 or FanDuel or Draft. It's just not because those are where people can basically experience the thrill of risk. And all they care about is facilitating that thrill of risk. They're not there for an intellectual combative nature of trading against the customer or anything like that. So the exchanges are appealing against people who have options as to how they scratch that intellectual itch. I argue that crypto trading is a bigger threat to potential new exchange customers than any other sort of bookmaking proposition. To me, it's like right now, I look at, you know, 0 day to expiry options on Robinhood. I look at crypto, you know, like for those people who want to play intellectual speculation games, maybe even they go down the Kalshi route or whatever, you know, like that's what I feel like the exchanges are constantly competing against to find their losing volume. And having heard you speak about, I feel like maybe you still hope the man on the street will recognize that price value proposition and be like, look, I'm just, literally, I know I'm going to, even the guy who just says, I know I'm going to lose slower because margins are lower. But like, I'm just wondering, do you feel I'm wrong to think that the exchange is exclusively for wonk people who want to play nerdy tech games? Or do you feel like there is still the opportunity for just literally the fun better to bet into this? Sorry, I've really dominated. It's supposed to be asking me questions. Instead, I've just sort of gone on for ages.
I'm enjoying listening to you. No, that was a really interesting setup. I think I largely agree with you in the fact that the exchange appeals. Okay, let's take a step back. I think we need to differentiate between the exchange interface and the exchange as a venue for people to trade. Because I think they're two different things. So if we take the exchange interface, or at least this sort of buying and selling mechanism in sports, I think you're right that it appeals to more of an intellectual, gamey type of person. And I completely agree that there's a lot of other competing products now that might be interesting. You know, you mentioned crypto trading or zero-day options or day trading or whatever. You know, this sort of the new crypto thing, like that wasn't around, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years ago. So there's definitely more opportunities for people to do that. On the other hand, I think the sort of this super recreational sports bettor, they've been largely enticed with what we call, what I call lottery bets, you know, basically where you have high payouts, whether it's same game parlay, bet builders types, or, you know, just a multiple, aka parlay. A lot of the retail recreational bettors tend to like these 30, 40, 50 to one style bets that, you know, they're not going to hit very often, but, you know, the thrill of potentially getting 50 to one on a night is very enticing. So I think the exchange is definitely getting squeezed from those two areas. So I don't know if you've had a chance to see SBK, but that was part of our hypothesis with SBK of the exchange interface is too complicated for normal bettors. If you look at the UK market, 90% plus market shares on sportsbooks, 10% minus market shares with the exchanges. But there's a lot from a venue perspective, there's a lot of advantages to an exchange style model over more of an old school bookmaker model. Why don't we try to take the best of both worlds? So that's what we did with SBK. So SBK is built on top of our exchange, gets the pricing from the exchange, but all the complexity is abstracted away. And we have some ideas how we want to spruce up our trading interface. But if we keep, so our interface is largely very similar to Betfair from the sense of we wanted to resegment customers, and that's what people are used to, and that's what BetDAQ did. And so we kind of have that sort of that UK old school exchange interface. If we keep it that way, I do think it's going to keep shrinking. Like, I don't think that market is definitely not growing. But I do think there's an opportunity to have a better interface to kind of bring back some of those crypto traders and people that want to buy and sell. But I think what is more interesting from a long-term play is really creating the right ecosystem. So opening up the API again and trying to find ways to get more retail order flow is it's sort of the way we talk about getting more money into the system. So I think the exchange as a venue is 100% necessary. Whoever is going to be the winner in 5, 10, 15 years, in my opinion, whatever serious winning bookmaker will have to be built on top of an exchange. Whether there will be an exchange interface as like a major interface in sports betting, I'm skeptical on that. But I do firmly believe in exchange. Whether you're Bet365 or whether you're FanDuel or whatever, because markets are going to get compressed, the price updates are going to get faster at some point. And the sort of that old school guy in front of the screen watching a baseball game hitting an up arrow on a keyboard, that's not going to fly in some point in the future. It'll be too inefficient and slow.
There's a degree of, well, in my mind, a degree of irony now that if SBK as an entity went to the syndicates that have now moved into B2B, they will provide the liquidity to SBK. They will mark and make SBK effectively as a proposition, having turned you down as an opportunity to mark and make into the exchange. Because it's interesting that, you know, there has been this attempt by people who have been exchange market makers for many years to pivot into this B2B space. As everyone likes to say, like, it's great to be in the picks and shovels game. It's funny how people say that right up until they actually try doing it and having observed the B2B side. I think what's funny is that the one thing that has broken more hearts than anything else is the fact that people observe Sportradar from the outside. And Sportradar is a very successful B2B business. And it, like so many of these things, hinges on one very key small fact in that someone realized just how there are debates internally in Sportradar as to how accidental this was really, but how valuable data would be. And so, you know, essentially when people say to me, like, look at Sportradar's products, you know, this, like that, they've built some very good products. I definitely, some of them good, some of them medium, some bad, like any company. But essentially what it came down to is like, there's massive invoices for live data every single year. So, you know, B2B success is literally via a pen and a contract, you know, like sporting body A, we pay this, you send us data, building an API is trivial, we then sell it to other people. I do find that kind of like people like, you know, don't look into how B2B companies actually really make their money before thinking B2B is easy. But anyway, so the syndicates go into this situation whereby, as you say, volume's dwindling, how can we, you know, keep revenues growing? We're so good at pricing, because we've been market making exchanges for years. We go out and we provide bookmakers with the expert service, but we can't necessarily provide all sports. you know, we're experts in our narrow field because that's how we got so good at what we do, is because we focused on something. But what I find interesting is that still for the exchanges to no matter how smart the individual, I like to have at least two smart individuals per market if I can. And I found it interesting talking, you know, hearing Alex Kane talk about the market making solutions that they deployed for sport trade, because I think one thing that Betfair opened the Colosseum. Betfair allowed like Darwinian selection. So there are many market makers who went bankrupt over the years in Betfair. Many people who came, maybe even made money for a good period of time, then got crushed out. And so number of like high-level market makers in Betfair is smaller now than it had been. But at least you know that all of those people are battle-tested and they're all, you know, going to be compete. They learn how best, you know, to compete for the best bid, best offer in their chosen area, et cetera. What I'd be interested is that if I, let's say I found two people who did horse racing and SBK said like, okay, you know, I want a B2B horse racing provider. They would be absolutely like, well, obviously I'm exclusive. And I'd be tempted to say, why should you be exclusive? I've built a sports, but the sports book will just display the best odds from the best B2B provider I put in. Well, no, we don't want to do that. Well, you do it on the exchange. So the exchange, you know, but so then you've got this scenario where it's like, okay, so what you're hoping for is an easier ride than you had make exchange market making. So basically you're looking for the bookmaker to make your life easier. The bookmaker's got to pay all the marketing costs to get the business in the door. Bookmaker's like doing all the payment processing fees, doing all the KYC, doing all the AML, doing all this other stuff. I find it very interesting, this kind of clashing of worlds of like people who are understanding how expensive it is to run a bookmaker, people who think they have the absolute hot shit trading product, you know, so you should be falling over backwards to get this in. I certainly hope that if the garden goes back to being open again, I would hope that you can convince, as you say, for the back end, for the sports book to really sit on the exchange back end. In a weird way, I almost would have no recreational people on the exchange. The exchange would be 10 market makers just fighting in the dark with each other with no UI to maintain, nothing at all. And my UI is the sports book. You know, maybe even I just switch off the exchange, but know that I've got 10 guys who I've got contractually obliged to provide this much liquidity over this time frame before kickoff during life, whatever. But yeah, I mean, I have looked at SBK, go back to that. And one thing that there is agreement amongst the people I speak to is that everyone likes the look, right? And that's definitely important. You know, when people say like Robinhood's success in many ways comes down to the absolute brutal simplification of the UI and the fact that it sprays little sparkling emojis at you when you make money. So like no one can argue against the beauty contest element of like web-based products. And I think SBK is a nice looking product. I'm going to say hats off to the team at Smarkets who put that together. But yeah, if the Smarkets, the exchange is going to be the engine, obviously there is the challenge in getting that competitive Colosseum effect going on behind you.
I think you're like, you know, from one market making geek to another, I think you're thinking about in sports betting, still the margins are pretty wide. So even, you know, when we're market making on the exchange, we're trying to market make to like a 2% house edge or 3% house edge blended. And when you're making, you know, if you go back to your days in FX, like, you know, I imagine if you're a professional FX trader, you're fighting for one bip, two bips, I don't know, so, like something infinitesimally.
On euro dollar, but like, that's like saying, you know, on the 1x2 for the EPL, 5 minutes to kick, that's the euro dollar right there. But believe me, if you're trading like peso yen, there'll be some eye ripping going off. That's for absolute sure, you know, right?
Well, I think sports betting is more like peso yen, right? Mm-hmm. And so you don't need the gladiators in the Colosseum, so to speak, because most things are very wide. They're very, relatively speaking, illiquid. And so the pricing is not the hard part. The hard part is to go get the retail flow. So I think the betting syndicates are a little bit on the outside looking in now because everything relies on getting access to that order flow. And historically, betting syndicates have had access to pools of liquidity, whether it's through runners, whether it's through exchanges, or whether it's through Asia. Those are kind of the three methods that syndicates were able to get access. Asia's drying up, the Betfair exchange or the UK exchanges are drying up, and, you know, runners is not a very scalable business model. So I think that's why they're a lot of syndicates are trying to get more into the retail order flow by becoming B2B. But from our perspective, you know, we do the pricing ourselves and we're pretty happy with the pricing that we're offering. And that, you know, I think if you had a euro dollar trade, like, I think there's more of an argument to be working with professionals to kind of bring them in. But if you have a wide bid offer spread, you want to take that all day long, you know?
Well, I mean, but then again, we can circle back to the adverse selection problem and the information asymmetry, as it always is the be all and end all, really. And that the great thing about if I'm trading, like, so peso yen is it's a synthetic. So it's dollar Mexican peso and dollar yen, basically. And you do the math to do that. There is some organic flow between them, though. So if you're Japanese manufacturers and you need Mexican silver, there is dumb money. And when I say dumb money, I don't mean it in the derogatory sense. There's money that just like, well, we
retail
need...
Retail order flow.
Yeah, well, it's not even... It's large. It's that global corporate we need to buy.
Yeah, I still call that retail order flow, though, because they're not price sensitive. It's big, chunky, dumb money, like you say.
Yeah, so I would say that, you know, the stuff that is like the peso, yeah, like when you're doing like handball handicaps, well, what spread is wide enough sometimes? Because, you know, I don't think the Hansen market makers have become exports in handball in the last 10 years necessarily. So it's kind of one of those things where, yes, the bid offer is wide, but I would say that because of the nature of the sports market making problem, it, like, there just isn't enough uninformed money at times to justify the tighter spread. And the weird thing is that the very same market, so, you know, Manchester United versus Manchester City, that is one, not one uniform risk profile. A week where it may be one spread, explicitly around the point that lineups are announced, there may be another spread. 5 minutes keeps another spread, like halfway through the first half is another spread kind of thing. So it's kind of, I don't ever begrudge people market making in a widespread or bookmakers with large margins. I think fairness in other areas, you know, is definitely not being delivered. But if someone wants to say, this is my markup, you can see the markup, trade or don't trade, I can deal with that. I always, you know, that's something that I don't begrudge people too much, mainly because I've done it. And I think, I know that you aspire to the tighter spreads, but you've also been punched in the face doing this as well. So I'm sure at times you can kind of appreciate, I'm pretty sure Hansen has had to post liquidity on stuff where you're like, this should be 50 ticks wide. We're going to have to go 10 ticks wide. And that,
every day.
That's what we're stuck with. One thing I want to say about, so political markets, right? I know that you're a political junkie. I know that you love it. I know you love getting really into the weeds of it. I have this thing whereby in the sports betting world, we have things that literally will settle every second, all the time. We are getting constant grading of markets all the time. And yet the political markets, the liquidity does obviously gravitate heavily towards things that happen over year cycles. The general elections in the UK, the presidential, you know, in the US. And so for me, it's kind of like after the fact, they always make incredible storylines, like exchanges turned over, you know, 500 million in election or whatever. But in terms of, A, I don't know how big the pool of political bettors, they're I know lots of people who are political bettors because I'm in my own little bubble where I meet lots of people who bet in all sorts of specialisms. But I do think that there's this sort of the problem of using politics as the poster child of exchange betting is that, I mean, it's just so slow to get my gratification right. I don't know, like, do you see, so SmartMarkets has always put more effort than the other exchanges into their political markets. Do you see, like, a lot of people actively, constantly managing positions, trading in and out, constantly doing that? Or do you just see a lot of set and forget? Yeah, Biden wins, there's my bet. 6 months away, but that was a good price at the time I took it. Or do you actually see people actively churning in the political markets?
You're absolutely right. I mean, it's tiny. It's like sports betting is tiny. Like, we'll have more traded on a championship correct score than we will on major political markets. So it's just, it's a very niche part of the business. It's part of the reason why we've just had to get so good at sports, just because politics is so slow. It's so unpredictable. It's not repeatable. It just has like really horrible properties for event trading. So besides the fact it's really interesting to see where things are trading, it's pretty slow. We have a group of passionate political bettors that are on there, and there will be people who are trading in and out, but it's a small passionate group. It's not a large group of people. Well, my vision for political betting was sort of similar to the Japanese factory needing to buy a Mexican silver example. I kind of thought that once you sort of scale this out to a significant degree, you could institutionalize it. So if people want to hedge their exposure to Trump doing this or Biden doing that, or, you know, like say Biden's really investing in solar and Trump's going to cut those subsidies, you could go and buy Trump contracts to hedge your exposure if you're a solar. I think that's definitely 10, 20 years down the future. But I think if the event market ever sort of establishes itself, I think it could become an asset class based on kind of like a blocky insurance kind of contract style trading. Not sort of, I don't think it'll be that analogous to sports betting, like the correct scores tonight. Like, do I want to buy nil-nil, sell nil-nil? It's more sort of institutions buying and selling contracts on that.
So a good example, let's say, so ops markets would have had Brexit markets at the time. Do you allow handsome algorithms to actually market make in those situations, or do you just assume there's enough liquidity from P2P that it doesn't have to be involved? Did you
There's very few things that we don't market make. We market make almost everything.
So what I would call sort of opinion agnostic market making in that situation, or did you take a view? Because you are deep into it. So were you there saying, I think the vote's going to fall this way? Or are you like...
We took a view, but our views tend to be more based on the passive algorithm. You know, we're not taking a view from the perspective that we think Brexit isn't going to happen. Let's cheat the price this way. It's more like what the computer ends up trading it out to be. But we have a view. We have a view on Biden. We have a view on Trump. We're very short Trump, I think. So we're very long Biden and very short Trump. And that's not because we think Biden's going to win. It's just sort of like where the flows are coming from. Another, you know, along up there with information asymmetry and adverse selection should be one-sided order flow. You know, very, very, very common in sports betting, at least in the exchanges, that you get one-sided order flow. So there's a lot of people that want to bet on Trump, so we become short Trump, and a lot of people that are negative on Biden, although the market just flipped, interestingly. I think Biden went ahead of Trump for the first time like a week or two ago in the market. So no, we have positions on everybody. We almost never trade to market neutral because there's not another venue that we can go. The transaction fees are too high for us to go to another venue and hedge out. And the public's interest is so one-sided that we will never get two-sided order flow. So we're just kind of used to that.
So it really is about a set. I mean, it's averaging in at this point at the best possible price that you can achieve.
Yeah, and hoping that you didn't get screwed along the way, and sometimes you do, and sometimes you don't. You know, if you think we're trading, I think 50,000 contracts concurrently, and I don't know how many markets, like 20 markets, 5,000 events, something of that order of magnitude. You know, on balance, you're making your 2-4% per market, and that adds up to our revenue.
I suppose quite a specific question that someone like me would potentially ask. So when some early-ish years of Betfair had definitely become a thing. So when I worked at IG Index's sports spread betting division, we basically, IG had already been doing some market make on the FTSE 100 up-down markets. So basically very short-term binary options, which at the time were actually quite popular on Betfair. And it made sense as a spread betting company that sort of specialized in financial markets that they would be able to market make those. And they required a certain degree of, you know, domain knowledge to do so. And the byproduct of this is that the sports back end had the ability to price things into both Betfair and BetTac, back to this is 2004, that kind of era. And what was quite funny was, I tell this story to people sometimes, is that back then Betfair's commission was 5%. You got Betfair points the more you traded, and you could get down as low as 2%. And so we said, well, obviously we don't need to do that, right? We'll start on 2%. And the people at Betfair, God bless them at the time, said, no, what the fuck are you talking about? And we're like, well, we're going to be providing like liquidity in a lot of sports here. Like, I mean, surely there's some sort of corporate rate or something like that. And they went, no, you'll get it down to 2% by yourself, like normal people. We were like, fuck, okay, right? And the funny thing is, like within one weekend, we got down to 2%. So it was like, it was kind of a very weird scenario. But what was relevant to me was also I was on doing some rugby at the time. And rugby was just empty boxes on Betfair all the time. And we...
Still is.
We created a system which would just populate. It was very, like, so that if you've got your fair price, add it up to 100%. And basically would populate box 1, 2, and 3. We always agreed that if we were going to create the impression of, you know, activity, the visible boxes all needed to be filled. And we didn't do anything to make the look organic. It would literally come up, you know, there'd be empty boxes. I'd be trading my game. I'd click the button and it would go like 50, 100, 200, something like that. And it would be kind of like 5 ticks, 10 ticks, 15 ticks or whatever wide. Like that. It was literally like, you know, it was very transparent that a machine was doing it. And it was funny because the Betfair forum back then was sort of quite a lively space for, you know, ship posting, and of course, but also, you know, there were some good ideas exchanged. A lot of people talk very fondly about that. But I used to go on the rugby forums and like straight away the message would be like, oh yeah, the bot's up, you know, like, and people would sort of talk about them and people would sort of talk about like how stupid it was. But the reality is that it also built this idea that the most important thing back then, particularly conceptually for exchanges, was the idea that you could, you know, in the pre-cash out era, was that you could basically get out of your bet. You could back and then you could lay and get out. And the fact that we were there visible with these very blunt, obvious blocks, you'd look at it and go, okay, so there's always going to be £50 there, 5 ticks wide, because that's what they do. So if I back 50, I know I'm going to be able to lay my 50. No problem. It'll always be there. And we actually got preferential rates. Like I think for most of rugby, for example, we didn't pay any commission. And Betfair were happy to allow us to try and drive that. Now, one thing that I have spoken to people about is very obviously by displaying all your order book depth, shall we say, you know, your value proposition bluntly like that, I think engenders some confidence from the user in their ability to trade and use the product. Of course, it's also a complete, this is the adverse selection game you're playing, like a bookmaker, essentially, but we know we're doing both sides, etc. Now, users of Smarkets or any exchange will often be presented with the £2 here, £10, oh, there's £70 there. What's that doing there? Like this kind of very bitty look. And when you go to a bookmaker, you know, quite often if they have the kindness of having a max bet button, you can just go max bets or £500. And it feels like, oh, one click, I get £500. And then someone else will be like, well, you know, if you add up all those boxes, though, you would have got £500. At a better price than that 500, just requires a bit more clicking and like people's eyes glaze over and it's like, why would I spend time working in order to get my whatever, you know, they just don't want to do it. So what I was interested is that with Hans, did you think about having, obviously if Hans is going to be something that is out to, you know, generate alpha, it needs to have sort of a concealed element to it. I don't see how it's possible to be a blunt instrument. But did you ever consider something that was quite blunt, something that does just post blocks? Because if we look at like a recent handout that got passed around for a matchbook like posts all these snapshots about like, look, this is this much liquidity available at this time. Now, whether this is kind of the exchange equivalent of virtue signaling as look at our liquidity and whether it's meaningful liquidity, it's probably not a debate we necessarily need to have now. But did Smarkets consider a blunter form of market making to create the visual impression of greater liquidity ever? Was that something you ever considered or went or tried at any point?
Yes.
Right.
Perception matters. Perception matters. I mean, you got to fill the screen. So the exchange market looks pretty lonely when there's just sort of a bid and offer there. So for a large part of the, it depends on the market, but we will still put 3 ticks of prices up there. Some of it is, I would say it's mostly what's the right word? Cosmetic, but there are some reasons for like staying in front of the queue. And, you know, if somebody wants a bigger bet, they can kind of go get a worse price and take a bigger bet. So there are reasons to have different levels of liquidity, but a large part of it was to sort of, you know, make the market look active. So we definitely did that.
Do you think you could make it look active with bigger blocks?
Of course. It's a computer, isn't it?
Well, obviously I know technically it's capable, but I don't see... I'll give an example, you know, like when I worked at Mustard, quite often the way we would be posting was, okay, golf in particular I worked on, if you work on a liability perspective, you know, £2 at 1,000 versus £2,000 at evens kind of thing, you know, there's that element to it. We would often have, let's call it the intent, so iceberg style orders effectively. So we'd have the trading intent in our back end and we would show in the amounts that we felt appropriate this kind of drip feed thing. Now, I often felt that how do you know if there is an aggressive blunt instrument human out there who wants to click big numbers if you don't give them the opportunity to try and click big numbers? So I'm thinking to myself, yes, you put yourself at risk, but do you want to be putting out the 500-pound blocks at a wider tick range to try and see if those people are out there? Or is that just fool's gold? Is there, there is no good business to be had by doing that. You've always got to be cautious. You've always got to be, you know, layering fivers, tenors, twenties. Is that?
Well, I think the answer to, well, I, to be honest, it's a very interesting thing to explore. But my guess is those people who would be tempted by that 500 block and to pay over the odds to kind of get matched at that, those people are on the sports book. You know, those people aren't okay. Sitting there working in order on the exchange. They can be, but so we haven't experimented too much with that, sort of different sizes of the second and third ticks, so that to see if that increases more trading action on the exchange. Where we do use the second and third ticks is for the sports book. If people want to place bigger bets, we make sure that we have the right price for the second and third tick, so that, you know, we have the price that we're willing to match and the liquidity is there for people to go trade against it. I'm going to have to wrap, unfortunately. I love this conversation. I was just thinking during it, like, maybe we should do, if people are interested, the kind of like Lex Friedman style, you know, you and I sit across from each other. We go into this for 3 or 4 hours because I feel like there's a lot more interesting things that we could get into. And it sounds like we kind of grew up in the same era, like thinking the same things. And so it's really interesting to kind of get your perspective and challenge me a little bit on some of our assumptions. So I've really enjoyed this chat.
As have I. Thank you very much for allowing me to grill you. I'm not going to ask you what you want to be when you grow up.
I'm going to ask you, what do you want to be when you grow up?
I actually thought about this question, but expecting it. I will say, when I was 15, so mid-90s, computers and internet, early, you know, early stage, like, but I was at a expensive boarding school, so we had nice computers and we did have the internet. And I was asked to do a careers test. To find, but they let you alone to do it and you could redo it as many times as possible. And I knew that my father had earmarked me for something like investment banking or something like that. And so I redid it. I just redid it again and again until I put in the answers that got like finance professional or whatever. But the very first things when I did it just normally were, and I still am, I did a history degree. I love history. I love reading historical, you know, watching history documentaries, history podcasts, all the rest of it. And it gave me historian, teacher, and librarian.
Okay.
And one of the most joyful parts of my life when I was most at peace is when I was doing my dissertation at LSE and got access to the British libraries. So there's texts that aren't sort of widely available. So they have to go into some vault to dig them out kind of thing. And I thought to myself, if I could be, people who haven't been to the British Library, it's absolutely, to me, a must go. It's fabulous. And I would say that if I could have been a librarian in the British Library, that, and I've railed so hard to do like things that other people, like a lot of my friends think that bookmaking and trading is really cool. It's amazing how uncool it is a lot of the time, to be honest. And it's amazing how I would think to myself, God, librarian, what a boring job that is. But no. If I can do it all again, I'm going to do what the test told me, and I'm going to be an librarian. I'm going to read books. I'm going to look after books, and I'm going to help other people enjoy books. That's what I think I'd do.
That sounds fantastic. Well, thank you so much.
Pleasure.
The Business of Betting podcast is presented by Optimove, the number one CRM marketing solution for the iGaming industry. 4 out of the top 5 U.S. operators personalize player experiences with Optimove, the number one CRM marketing solution for the iGaming industry. If you are attending SBC Summit North America, make sure to visit the Optimove stand at the event in New Jersey from May 7th to 9th. And we'll look forward to seeing you there.